Let's get into a National Geographic article from February 1937, written by Douglas Chandler, entitled Changing Berlin. And Chandler, and I assume the National Geographic's hearing so much of what was coming out of Germany and what was happening in Germany, decided to go to Berlin and see exactly what was going on. What had Germany manifested into from the Weimar Republic to the National Socialist control of Germany, and to see what Hitler's Germany really looked like. So we start the article on the first page as Chandler is getting off the plane into Berlin. He says, "The silver-haired lady whose chance acquaintance I had made in the plane with a red cross on its tail was met by her husband. Presentations concluded, she insisted that I accompany them in their car to my hotel. You'll find our city in a state of transition, she remarked as we sped on our way. The pompous old architectural forms are vanishing. I am a native Berliner, but I don't deplore the change. In fact, I'm happy to see the new age evolving, a style of realistic beauty in keeping with today's practical needs. I was astonished at this expression of tolerance for the upsetting of tradition. But it was only the first of many such surprises. Come and dine with us when you can. Find a breathing spell," said my host as we drew up before the address I had given. I accepted with warmth and waved them goodbye from the curb. Ensconced in the high-ceilinged room of the hotel to which I had been recommended, I set myself to the task of a cursory orientation by means of a little green book, Berlin from A to Z, in an official directory. As my eye roved through the alphabetical list of city streets, I realized that here before me was the itemized history of the Mark of Brandenburg. Important victories on the battlefield and the generals who won them, names of former margraves, princes, and kings, religious upheavals and the leaders who sponsored them, wizards of science, poets, painters, philosophers, and musicians, outstanding personalities of the new government. These and a multitude of other events and individuals are recorded among the names of the 9,500 streets within the city. Luther Street and Luther Bridge. Ah, here is our heroic reformer of the little town of Wittenberg. His pronunciamento brought, some two centuries later, an influx of French Huguenots into Protestant Brandenburg. Therefore, one finds a Franzose Strasse, or a French street, with its French church, and likewise a French school, in which to this very day French is the spoken language. So he goes on naming off some of the street names, which is something I find admirable. Many of the street names were named after heroes of Germany or contributors to the German culture. All right, so we fast forward a little bit. Bearing my Berlin from A to Z, I sallied forth into the huge metropolis. The baffling element of Berlin's character is its extreme simplicity. One anticipates complexities which do not exist. The city is unaffected and logical as the language spoken by its inhabitants. Before one can begin to comprehend what makes Berlin tick, preconceived ideas of capitals must be cast aside. Gradually, out of the confused outlines of the vast mass emerges a recognizable pattern. Behold the anomaly of an urban agglomeration. With a total population of some 4,222,000, a city which can boast one of the most highly perfected transportation systems in the world, with every convenience contributed by science, and yet which contains within its limits the following: 20,000 cows, providing a third of the milk supply, 30,000 pigs, 10,000 goats, 700,000 chickens, 180,000 rabbits, and 5,800 people keeping bees. Only three or four buildings that I could find as much as 10 stories high. So not these ghastly personality-less skyscrapers that are just simply made to look like project buildings housing a bunch of cubicle workers. not to go off on a tangent, but when one sees the plans for what Berlin was supposed to look like, it's a pity that it never came to fruition. We continue on. 12 windmills still functioning and more than 100,000 little gardens, the harvest of which includes such imposing yearly figures as 46,000 tons of potatoes and proportionate quantities of other vegetables and grains. Such items would appear fantastic to the dweller on narrow, rock-ribbed Manhattan. These little Schrebergartens afford city workers easily accessible contact with the land, which is so dear to the German heart. They promote bodily fitness through exercise and minimize food cost. Besides, each garden is a neat little house for storing equipment. Here centers the odd hour and weekend life of substantial numbers of families. During times of crisis, these wee shelters have even housed many who otherwise would have been roofless. The so-called Schrebergarten movement, which has spread to most cities of Germany, was founded in 1864 by a philanthropist who named it in honor of Schreber, a famous physician of that day. The land is owned, in some cases, by the city, in others by the state, and is furnished to its users, together with implements and seed, at a nominal price. Trees and rivers, more trees. Therein lies Berlin's greatest hold on the hearts of his dwellers. So already you're seeing it's a mixture of the modern city with nature. You're having gardens everywhere. You have livestock throughout the city. It is not this purely concrete hell as, say, a New York, or as Chandler here says, Manhattan. These small streams and their tributaries, connected by canals with the Elbe and the Oder, give communication for transport of freight by steamer and barge to the farthest corners of the land. Berlin has, except for Duisburg, the largest shipping tonnage of any inland city in Germany. More than 5 million tons of goods arrived at the port in 1935, and 1,300,000 tons were dispatched. Through the watery lanes, under gracefully arched bridges, of which Berlin has 1,006, even more than Venice itself, glide long wooden barges, heavy laden carriers of coal, building materials, petroleum, and infinite variety of other products. Large numbers of fruit barges come in from the provinces, bringing apples, pears, and peaches in their holds. In some cases, these loads are marked directly from the barges, which find a mooring at advantageous points within the town. The banks of the rivers are planted densely with trees. Rows of lindens, or plane trees, line the majority of the streets. The public parks are standing armies of trees in close formation, through which cut beguiling avenues and paths. The most numerous member of the tree family is the linden. Also in large numbers are found most of our familiar American trees, such as maple, elm, horse chestnut, much beloved by the German, oak, acacia, poplar, and birch. A census of trees standing in the streets and squares alone, entirely exclusive of the parks, totals 500,000. The Berliners' love of trees is so deep that in many cases where city appropriations have not provided the necessary funds, private citizens have paid for the planting of their own streets. As I walked through the streets of the old city, I found myself humming a line from the Princeton Triangle Club play way back in the dim ages of the Wiley Pure Food Act. Renovate, rejuvenate, and incidentally change the date. It ran, the jingle describes aptly the evolution taking place today in Berlin. Venerable, and in many cases unbeautiful, landmarks of a bygone day are being sacrificed to the demands of traffic. Scaffolds clamber over the facades of many old buildings, which do not have to suffer demolition, but are going through a much-needed facelifting operation. The town hall, a mammoth red brick structure, has recently emerged, rubicund and a bit garish, from an all-over bath performed by steam and cleansing acids. Okay, he goes on about many of the buildings either being restored or preserved if they're the older ones. We'll skip ahead a little bit. The pace of Berlin's pedestrian is conspicuously unhurried. Motor traffic, on the other hand, is unusually rapid. The drivers of the 620 omnibuses hurl their two-story leviathans from stop to stop in lurching bursts of speed. The air brakes hiss with splendific suddenness. The comparatively small number of motor vehicles in Berlin helps explain the village-like appearance of most streets. Counting private cars, trucks, and motorcycles, registrations from 1936 show only a few more than 40,000. The traffic flow has a heartbeat of 30 seconds, half a minute of red light, an orange flash warning of change, followed by half a minute of green. To one accustomed to the longer intervals of most American cities, it seems at first a little hysterical in its frequency of interruption. Upon arrival, I was petrified to see autos passing stopped streetcars. The law, however, permits such passing, with the injunction that is to be performed with extreme care. The large number of bicycles on Berlin streets creates an additional hazard for the motorists, especially as the riders seem endowed with a sublime faith that the vagaries of their delicate vehicles will be unfailingly observed by truck and car behind them. Yet with it all, casualty statistics are not high. The city's fatalities from traffic accidents totaled 358 for 1935. The traffic lights halt squads of cyclists, girls in unbecoming but practical divided skirts, delivery boys carrying bundles bigger than themselves, tenders of street lights pedaling precociously from lamp to lamp with 8-foot ladders strapped to their shoulders. The Berlin resident receives 4 deliveries of mail a day on weekdays and 1 on Sunday for good measure. 5,000 post boxes announce their presence on street corners with a lustrous surface of red, that shade which someone has described as the color of audacity. Until within the last year, they were a sober blue, but the color experts announced that they lacked visibility. Special delivery obtains, but for those who desire extra rapid service, there is the fast-functioning pneumatic tube system reaching every section of the town. This is a convenience to the businessman and an undoubted blessing to exigent lovers. I posted in Midtown an important airmail letter, business strictly, 1 hour before the starting time of the Stuttgart plane. The letter reached Tempelhof Airport in proper time and was delivered to its destination in Stuttgart 4 hours later. "How many skyscrapers have you in Berlin?" I asked the white jacket Scupo directing traffic. A Scupo is basically a policeman who protects traffic. "None that you Americans would call by that name," was his answer. "But," he added, "we have 3 or 4 that seem pretty tall to us and a radio tower to boot." I paid my entrance fee and rode up to the roof garden of the Europa House, the newest cloud scratcher, 11 stories high. There, surrounding an actual garden with blossoming flower beds and gravel walks, were tables set in wind-protected alcoves. While I ate my luncheon, I envied the sun baths being enjoyed by earlier lunchers on steamer chairs strewn about the lawn for the free use of roof guests. As there are no other high buildings or smokestacks adjacent, there was no soot to mar the picture. Berlin is not suffering from a lack of educational institutions with its 13 universities, colleges, and higher technical centers, 147 high schools, and 503 grade schools. Berlin University, center of educational life, fronts on the Unter den Linden across from the State Opera House. Such a dignified atmosphere of scholarship pervades the lovely gray buildings and its linden-shaded court. that no one would suspect was originally built as a palace for Prince Henry by his brother Frederick the Great. In the neighborhood of the university are several restaurants where one hears more English spoken than German. The guests are primarily exchange professors from American colleges who come to Berlin to research or other scholastic purposes. Modernism is not aggressively present today in painting and sculpture. The windows of the moderate price art shops are filled with decorative prints and paintings designed largely to please the conventional taste. Scenes portraying the fecund grain-filled mountains, peaks piercing the upper ether, animal pictures, flower studies predominant. Only a few doors from the American consulate in Bellevue Strasse, street of the better art dealers, there has recently been opened an exhibition of the latest styles in modern furniture. Designs compare favorably with similar showings I have seen within the last year in other European countries. Ingenious use is being made of materials hitherto unknown to furniture making. Has anyone ever regretted the demise of a statistician? Once wrote a disgruntled epigrammatist, comprehensible point of view, but there are exceptions, and I had the luck to meet one. At the head office of the city's Bureau of Statistics, I found the chief, a person of considerable humor. Surrounded by diagrams and graphs, he fed me with such factual morsels as the following. 720,000 loaves of bread go each day to Berlin homes. 11 tons of coffee made from malt are drunk each year, and only two-thirds as much real coffee. Some 50 million people annually visit Berlin's 400 movie houses. Meat consumption is on the downgrade, having dropped in 1 year from 157 to 127 pounds per person. Beer consumption has shrunk 40% in the last 8 years, a fact of much significance as foreshadowing the physique of the future Berliner. Now, however, the youth of Germany, striving for physical efficiency, scorn anything but the most moderate beer drinker. They predict that paunchy waistlines and bulging necks will be unknown to the next generation. Unfortunately, that did not come to fruition because, as you could see, Germany was well ahead of the curve when it came to health. According to recent stats now, Germany is one of the fattest nations in Europe, almost on par with America. So, but as you can see, they had very high hopes for themselves of being healthy people and being moderate in their beer drinking and consumption of alcohol. Nowadays, Germany is one of the things it's famous for internationally is its Oktoberfest and gorging on alcohol. So yeah, you had this healthy nation who was limiting meat consumption, moderating alcohol intake, and remaining physically active. And just like the architecture of Germany, was destroyed, wiped out, and replaced by something ugly. But let's go on. A characteristic sight as one explores the various sections of Berlin is the sports fields with children or young people going through setting up exercises. With magnificent gusto, they bend and twist, flexing muscles in unison with the rhythmic counting of physical instructors. There are 236 of these fields scattered about the city, and in addition, 660 indoor gymnasiums. The bodily fitness of the present generation of youngsters is striking. I talked in a third-class railroad carriage with a group of brown-faced lads returning from their summer service in a labor camp. For 6 months, they had been up near the border of the Netherlands digging ditches. They described to me the routine of the camp life. Réveil at 5 a.m., a man-sized breakfast, which sounds more like a lunch, with soup, meat, and potatoes, ad lib, shovels flying until noon, another meal followed by an hour's enforced siesta, no manual labor at all in the afternoons, program of instruction followed by an hour or two of sport, evening of pastime in any preferred fashion. Lots of us go in for wood carving, stated one of my fellow travelers, and digging into his gear, he proudly exhibited a carved picture frame with the coat of arms of Dresden, his native town. in Dresden, infamously known for the civilian massacre by the British and the firebombing. Every German boy, regardless of social position, must, between 17 and 25 years of age, give 6 months of labor service to the state. Oh, I love that. Every German boy, regardless of social position, must, between 17 and 25 years of age, give 6 months of labor service to the state. There are 1,200 camps throughout Germany, with 166 workers to a camp. The men live in light wooden barracks pinned together with bolts, which can be transferred from place to place as each job is finished. And the brotherhood this builds, like you have every social class toiling together, working together, and then, you know, having fun together afterwards. So, yeah, it's, once again, reading through this article, it is pretty depressing because you see how far they were and what they were creating in the 1930s. And mind you, coming from the disgusting Weimar Republic, it didn't look like Germany could be saved, especially with the Treaty of Versailles and everything that took place after World War I. Then they quickly built this society, and only to be wiped away in the end. And then, you know, to be demonized for the next 60, 70 years. Irrigation of dry lands and swamp drainage are the exclusive tasks of these labor camps. No road making or other form of construction which could compete with paid labor. Service for the girls of Germany is not obligatory. However, it is the vogue to volunteer for such tasks as assisting workers in the fields or in the homes, caring for children, or substituting for an office or factory worker so that a person can take a vacation without pay. Stores are beckoned with announcements of autumn sales. Windows teem with merchandise, including conservative copies of Paris models to sell women with small incomes. Most of the people on the Berlin streets are well dressed, if that term can be interpreted to mean the wearing of good and comfortable clothes. Men's furnishing stores exhibit weird arrays of caricaturated dummies, attenuated and globular, clad in clothes as square built as a New England woodshed. The salesman explains that this rectangular effect is the American shoulder. Beauty parlors flourish. A bewildering assortment of jars set forth in their windows. A few of the better-known American cosmetic lines are to be found. Red lips are no rarity. The long-haired sisters in this country have always far outnumbered those with bobs. The problem of imports have been a grievous one for Germany. During the years, her borders have been hermetically sealed to outflow of gold. Barter has solved difficulty in the case of certain commodities. And to go more into that, look into the Nazi economy video on the Culture Thug BitChute channel, which will highlight some of the sanctions and arm twistings of other countries that wanted to deal with Germany, put forth by the Western powers. Bananas and pineapples from the Cameroons and coffee from Brazil, these and other exotic products are paid for with tractors, tools, and motor trucks. On the same basis, butter and eggs come from nearby Denmark, and there is a project under discussion for drawing on the Argentine beef supply. Much midnight oil has been burned in the research laboratories during recent years in the hunt for new, inexpensive synthetic materials. Little short of miraculous seem some of the results demonstrated to me in Berlin. Synthetic rubber is now so cheap that the stores use rubber bands for small paper parcels because it is more economical than string. The art of making the public conscious of unexpected needs is not yet highly developed. Advertising is still in the nursery stage. Highways are not cursed with helpful hints of complicating existence. Beauty preparations and cigarettes occupy the lion's share of magazine space. In the tram, subways, and elevated trains, instead of the large car cards which challenge the American eye, are narrow strips not more than 3 inches wide, proclaiming in rhyme the virtues of certain wares. One brand of furniture and one of orthopedic shoes preempt the entire lateral space of all cars. Verse also is much in vogue for the teaching of safety rules. One poetic plea against the evils of coughing and sneezing, which appears in every public convenience, may be freely translated thus. Hold it as your duty, brothers, not to give your germs to others. Cough not to your neighbor's face. Handkerchief's the proper place. If you feel impelled to sneeze, do it likewise, if you please. Humor is employed far and wide as every instrument of public education. Every railroad station has a bulletin board on which appear in lucid colors grotesquely exaggerated pictures of what will happen to you if you lean against the door, place your baggage insecurely in the rack, climb on moving vehicles, or fall victim to a dozen other pitfalls of the road. Determined to hunt up the worst of Berlin's tenement areas, I plotted out a two-day walk through the quarters where the other half lives. Nowhere did I find a spot which measured up to my conception of a slum. Many unfit dwelling houses on narrow streets have been torn down. In their place stand settlements, groups of apartments offering decent, moderately priced quarters for workers' families. Nearly 3,000 have been constructed. Some have small gardens attached. So, like any decent reporter, he sees all this beauty and all these good things going on in Berlin. He's like, well, let me go find the slums. Let me go see how this other half lives. And lo and behold, he finds it remodeled and moderately priced apartments for workers. And when you have a government and leader that actually care about the country and the people, instead of like some capitalist swine policies, this is what you get. You don't have these people living in these slums because they're your countrymen. They are your people. They are your extended family. So even the people at the bottom rung of the economic ladder, they will not be discarded in the pursuit of personal profit. The task of aiding the needy is being largely handled by a winter aid campaign. There are, in the whole of Germany, 1.25 million voluntary workers contributing their services, which has kept administrative cost of the organization down to 1% of the total sum handled. Principal among methods of raising money are lotteries, the sale of badges, and little handmade ornaments of negligible cost, and the one-dish meal once a month in private houses, restaurants, and hotels. Through the latter means alone, 365 million marks were raised in 1935. The idea is that one day in each month, the midday meal shall consist of just one dish instead of the customary three courses. The difference saved is turned over to the winter aid. This abstinence is purely voluntary, though all are asked to participate in the minor sacrifice. The beneficiaries of the charity are given commodities, not money. 16% of all coal burned for heating purposes is provided through the winter aid. In Berlin, a general average of 800 pounds of coal is delivered each winter to households with up to 2 children. For larger families, sufficient is provided to keep 2 stoves burning. Enormous quantities of clothing, shoes, and food are distributed. Where on earth are all the people? You find yourself asking as you walk through the deserted streets on a fine Sunday afternoon. Certainly, at this same hour, the Champs-Élysées is thronged with a chattering, strolling mob. But this is not France. We are in Germany, land of probably the most devoutly nature-loving people of the Northern Hemisphere. The Berliner, with his sisters and his cousins and his aunts and grandfather and grandmother thrown in, has joined a daybreak exodus to the woods and lakes. Those who own some sort of boat go by water route. By 8 o'clock, rivers and canals swarm with craft. Lining the shores are series of tent cities, aggregations of wood and canvas, weekend domiciles. Flowers fill a role of high spiritual importance in the lives of true Berliners. It is rare that one finds a residence without its blooming windows, boxes, or other cachets of burgeoning pigment. The flower vendors about the streets do a thriving business year in and year out. I visited the wholesale flower market. Rain was drizzling dismally, and the day was not one to invite early quest of beauty. Yet, at this hour, the market was swarming with buyers, both wholesale and retail. Florist wagons were being loaded with supplies for the day, and housewives were haggling over the purchase of small bunches. A law passed several years ago requires that electrocution be employed as the method for killing animals in the slaughterhouses throughout the entire country. Kosher killing is everywhere prohibited. The system of house numbering is about to undergo a much-needed change. Up to the present, buildings have always been numbered around a street, up the right side and back down the left. Great is the resulting confusion. A compilation of the minutes lost thereby since Albrecht the Bear first crossed the Spree would surely reach astronomical figures. An anomaly of public utility situation is dual ownership. Part of the system is owned by the city and the rest of the property of the state. This results in keen competition between different branches. The same dual ownership is found in the gas works and electric works. There is at present a sales of advertising war going on about the respective merits of gas versus electrical refrigeration. A surprising amount of road construction is now underway in around Berlin. The fine highway, when completed, will entirely encircle the city on its outskirts and will serve as a valuable time saver through traffic. Amazingly ambitious is the program of highways now in progress throughout the length and breadth of Germany. The roads are unusual in construction, of a depth and solidity which should ensure years of duration. Boulevards are built in double lanes. Each strip is a one-way road wide enough to accommodate four cars abreast. There are no crossings. All transverse traffic lanes, pass over, bridges, and intersections are provided with the four-leaf clover type of lead-in. When the now finished stretches are joined, one will be able to drive from the North Sea to the Austrian frontier in about 12 hours with a fast car. And as he finishes the article, winter comes to Berlin. At the close of my last day in Berlin, I stand on the north end of a bridge facing the curve of the Spree. Around me, a white cloud of gulls is tilting, crying through the sad hush of a failing autumnal day. Back from the Reichstag, which looms in the near distance, the setting sun throws a red glow on the ornate dome and the gilded horsemen. Across the bridge, returning from an outing, marches a group of small boys wearing the uniform of the Hitler Youth, short black trousers, brown shirt, and black neckerchief, slipped through the braided leather holder. They are singing an accurately pitched youthful tremble, that moving modern national song, Horst Wessel Lied. A faint chill creeps over the dusky, shimmering waters. Winter is not far away. I shall hie me back to my Schwarzwaldery and my skis. And that ends the article, Changing Berlin, from February 1937 by Douglas Chandler, in which he describes a beautiful city that had a mixture of modern innovation with nature-filled surroundings, of a people healthy, happy, in unison, that just prior, 8 years earlier, were literally burning money to stay warm. Now instead, the slums torn down, settlements built in its place. The poorest of the poor cared for by over 1.5 million volunteers, and the nation coming together to raise money to even help the poorest of the poor get back on their feet. Thankfully, there are articles like this National Geographic article from 1937 that still exist, so those of us who are raised in this modern era can go back in history and see what really existed and what really happened instead of the malicious lies and half-truths presented by modern education, modern media, and modern anti-German propaganda. So once again, 1937, February edition of the National Geographic magazine. I bought this reprint maybe 12 years ago. I don't know. I'm sure they still exist where you can buy the reprints. but I would suggest buying it. I forget what I paid, but the price is marked up, of course. But there's some beautiful illustrations and pictures that are in the magazine, which unfortunately, not all, I couldn't find all of them to place them in this video.